of this talk is to have a look at what computer science might have to say about life. And the first thing we're going to have to do is a little bit of background on computer science, but I'll try and keep it light. Think of it, if you like, as a hunt for the first computer. Maybe this is it. So this was dredged up from a sunken ship off the island of Antikythera, and it's called the Antikythera mechanism, and the media seem to think it was the first computer. All you can see in this picture really is a cogwheel with four spokes. But the entire mechanism has been reconstructed, so there on the left is what it might have looked like, a really handsome box made of wood with a bronze faceplate. And on the right is the gear train that would have been inside. And what it did was to keep track of the positions of the sun, the earth, the moon, and the five known planets at the time in order to do astronomical predictions. Probably the first example known of precision engineering. A remarkable thing. I wouldn't mind one for Christmas. Is it a computer, though? No, of course it isn't. It's an astronomical calculator. That's a small thing, a specialized calculator. You can't use it to add 2 plus 2, so it's not actually a calculator. And a calculator isn't a programmable calculator, and a programmable calculator isn't a computer. So in my book, it's rather a long way short. And that story tells us a couple of things. One is that when people are talking about computing, technology tends to dominate the discussion, and we've got to dig past that to find the science. And the other thing is that we're in desperate need of a proper definition of what a computer is so that we can tell the media off when they're wrong. Okay, so let's fast forward to my favorite year in history, which is 1936, which for me is the birth of the subject of computer science and is a kind of nexus where lots of things happened. But just before I tell you about the inventions and discoveries, we need to work out what computation was like by 1936. So here's a photo from the 1920s, actually, and in it there are 40 or 50 computers. Can you see them? They are the people. So the people are sitting in front of electric calculators, but it's the people who are making the decisions. They're the ones that count as the computers. So in a way, we've solved our problem already. We have found the first computer, the human brain. But I'm not saying the human brain is just a computer, but among other things, it can do computation. So we're going to discount the human brain and go keep on looking. So in 1936, there were three inventions. I'm calling them inventions because you can think of them as technology, if you like. And to cut a long story short, in modern terms, they are three programming languages. The first person to mention is Kurt Gödel, who invented a programming language called recursive functions. And the idea was to write down computations in a mathematically totally precise way for people to follow, but also to explore the limits of computation, what it means. And he upgraded his language, added another feature, and got general recursive functions, and discovered that he had increased the expressiveness of his language. More computations could now be expressed. And, of course, the question arose whether that was the limit or whether you could go on adding features to programming languages. And that's why mathematicians got excited about this subject at the time. It had to be mathematicians because there weren't any computer scientists yet. By the way, if you go looking up the subject of general recursive functions, it's not called that anymore. It's now called partial recursive functions for historical reasons, so beware. So after Kurt Gödel, another person that got involved in this question was Alonzo Church, who invented a language called the Lambda Calculus, which I'm not going to say any more about, to the great dismay of one of my colleagues at the back. And the third language was Turing machines, invented by Alan Turing of Enigma fame, though this was much more important. All Enigma did was to save thousands of lives and shorten the war by a couple of years. This has changed everybody's lives. So we will look at the Turing machine idea in a minute. So these inventions of programming languages led to some discoveries, which I mostly associate with Turing, but other people around the time were involved. And the first one is the Church-Turing thesis, and then the halting problem, and then universal machines. So I'll go through those one by one. The Church-Turing thesis. Now, I'm calling these things discoveries because, in my opinion, they are true science. So the Church-Turing thesis, after the two people that I mentioned earlier, it comes in two parts, and the first part is fairly simple. It says all those three languages that we just looked at are equivalent. They have the same expressive power. So anything you write in one of those languages, you can write in another one. Now, this is an easily proved mathematical thing because all you have to do is to show how to translate from one language to another as if it was English to French to German or something. The interesting part is part two, which says any programming language you ever invent in the future will not be any more expressive than these three. We have already done as much as we can do. That is a very powerful thing. But it's also not a mathematically provable thing. So we'll have to think about it a little bit harder. So another way of thinking about it is that there's a computation barrier, a bit like the speed of light in physics, that you can't get past. Computation only goes up to a certain point and then stops. And it's a little bit different from the speed of light because we think of the speed of light as being very difficult to attain, whereas this computational limit seems to be quite easy to attain. If this thing isn't maths and you can't prove it, is it technology? Well, no, because it doesn't matter what direction you approach it from. It is science because the only thing you can do with it is gain experience over time and build up a consensus of opinion, which is what happened and it's now accepted. And that's the birth of computer science for me, a new and distinctive kind of science. Okay, so that brings us on to the other two discoveries, but before I talk about those, I have to show you what a Turing machine looks like. So it's that blue thing in the middle with the TM logo on it, and it is acting on a paper tape, which is where it stores things, and what this particular Turing machine is about to do is to sort some letters. So a bit like the post office, but these letters are just A and B. So sorting them means we would expect at the end the A's to come first and then the B's. So expect the answer to be AA, BBB. So keep your fingers crossed. I'm going to start it off and see if it goes. There it goes. It's looking for the first A, swapping it with the first B. There's the first B. Now it's going looking for another A that's out of place. There it is up there. Then it's going to swap that with the first B. It has to go back to the A to find where the first B is, swaps it, and then it goes looking for another A that's out of place, and there isn't one, so it stops. So, of course, we want to know what a Turing machine looks like inside, so I'm going to have to open it up for you. And inside is what we would now call a state machine. That is, this machine can be in one of four states, 1, 2, 3, 4. There they are down the left. And it's looking at a particular square on its paper tape, and that can have one of three symbols on it, which are A, B, and blank. And each entry in this matrix or table tells the machine exactly what to do. So at the moment, it's in state one at the beginning. It's looking at a B, so you look up one B, and you find greater than two, which means move to the right and then go into state two. So the only operations that this machine can perform are move to the right, move to the left, put a symbol onto the paper, go to a different state, stop. That's it. So I hope you get the idea. Now, you can go to hundreds, maybe thousands of websites to find out what Turing machines look like and to see simulations like mine and all that. What really annoys me, though, is that almost none of them tell you why Turing machines are brilliant. So I'm going to try and explain why Turing machines are brilliant. They're not supposed to be practical. They're supposed to be used for thought experiments. And the reason they're brilliant is you can think about them in two different ways. So there's a low-level point of view where you look inside the machine at the instructions and you say, everything that's happening is really simple, it's really deterministic, it's obvious what's going on. It's clear that what this machine is doing is a computation. But there's another point of view, a high-level point of view, which says, suppose you take any computation you can possibly imagine. What does it mean to be a computation? It means there are some rules that you follow, and it's got to be deterministic, and it's got to be reliable and come up with the same answer every time, and that sort of thing. And any computation you can imagine can presumably, Turing said, be done by a suitably trained human being, a mathematician, he said. And if you watch the mathematician and you get out your measuring instruments and you look inside the brain of this poor guinea pig, you discover that that brain must be in a finite number of distinguishable states, because if it was infinite, they'd be fuzzy and you wouldn't have an exact result. So how many states might you need, and can you model that with a Turing machine? Answer, you can model it with a Turing machine, but how many states? Well, in extremely round numbers, a human brain has 10 to the 10 neurons, and each neuron can be in 10 states, so 10 to the 10 to the 10 states. That shows you this is not practical, this is a thought experiment. But it shows you that, in principle, any computation can be carried out by a Turing machine. And that's the intuitive argument. And then, as I said, you have to build up a consensus over time as to whether it's really right. Okay, so that brings us on to the second discovery, which is the halting problem. Turing discovered one particular problem that could not be solved by any program, any computation, and that is to work out whether a program will stop once you've started it. And I think, in a sense, it's pretty clear that this is not a computable problem, a problem that you can't solve computationally. Because if you could, take almost any conjecture in mathematics, write it as a program which searches for a counterexample, and then don't run that program, just ask whether it stops or not. And if you work out that it's going to stop, then it's going to find a counterexample the conjecture is false, and vice versa true, and therefore you can solve any conjecture in mathematics. That's not going to happen, so the halting problem is not solvable. So that shows that there is a limit on computation. It shows you roughly where it lives, and it gives us computer scientists a pain in the neck because it is guaranteed that we cannot fully analyze your program for you. We can't tell that your program is bug-free or is never going to crash or whatever. So that's why programs have bugs in. And then the third discovery was the discovery of the universal machine. So up to now, you have to design and build a new machine for each problem. So if I wanted to do a different problem, even just sorting A, B, and C, I would have to change my machine. And Turing said, no, you don't have to do that. You can build one machine for all time, and that will solve any problem you like. And this is a practical argument. This is not 10 to the 10 to the 10. Turing's original example, it's difficult to tell exactly how big it was, but I reckon it was roughly something like 100 states and 10 symbols that you could put on the tape. Some very clever people have squashed that down to 4 states and 6 symbols, or 6 symbols and 4 states. That is tiny. So a pretty small Turing machine is capable of solving any problem you like. So I'll just tell you how Turing proposed to do that. What he said was, take my universal machine, and suppose that you want to do it to solve a sorting problem like we saw before. What you do is you design a Turing machine to do the sorting, but you don't build the sorting machine. You write down the description of the sorting machine on the paper tape. So you take that table that I showed you, that matrix, and you write it out in symbols on the paper tape. You also write down the data that it's going to act on, the thing you want it to sort, the BABBA. And you spread the symbols out to leave room for some markers, and you have 2 markers, one to show where you are in the program and one to show where you are in the data. And what the universal machine does is it goes to the marker in the program and says, what does that say to do? And then it goes and does it on the data. And then it goes back to the program and back to the data and goes back and forth like nobody's business. So this universal machine You can think of it as simulating the sorter, or emulating it, or being an interpreter for it, or indeed just storing a program in the memory. Good. So this is the birth of the computer, really, because now we've got a definition for a computer. A computer is any machine, not necessarily a Turing machine, which is capable of simulating or emulating anything else, any other computation that you care to think of. I like the word universal, but we use the word for so many things that it's often called Turing complete, if you want the jargon. Okay, so now we've got a test that we can do. We can go to the Antikythera mechanism and say, is it universal? No, it's not. It's not a computer. We can pick a mobile phone out of my pocket, I haven't got mine at the moment, and say, is that a computer? Is it universal? Yes, it is. Yes, it is a computer. It's a great test. But we are left with a question, and the question is, what was the first technological computer? So we're going to exclude the human brain, we're going to exclude Turing's universal machine from 1936, and we're going to ask which actual physical bit of hardware was the first computer. Presumably all we have to do is to write down the candidates, pick the first one that's universal. So here is my list of candidates. Not every colleague would agree with me, but it's roundabout correct. And there are five of them, which is, of course, four too many, but what can you do? And all we need to do is to run our eyes down this and say, oh, that's the first one that's universal, and we're done. Unfortunately, there's a problem in practice. All these five machines are borderline, and there is judgment to be made. Three different kinds of judgment, at least, maybe others. One is a lot of these machines have a very limited memory, whereas a true Turing machine has an infinite memory. Does that matter? That's a judgment call. Many of these machines have to be rebuilt in order to solve the next problem. Is that building a new machine or reprogramming an old one using a kind of mechanical memory for the program? That's a judgment call. And my favorite judgment call, maybe it's universal, but only by accident. Nobody at the time understood what that meant, and therefore, maybe it's not really a computer. So we're going to quickly run through in picture form the five candidates. So this is a reconstruction of a very tiny part of the analytical engine. This is from 1837, so it's 100 years ahead of its time. Babbage and Lovelace, mostly Babbage on the hardware side and Lovelace on the software side. It was never built. It could never have been built. It can't be built today because mechanically speaking, it's impossible. On the right are the kind of punched cards that might have been used if it had ever been built to store the program. Was it universal? We don't know for sure because the design was never completed and tied down. Babbage was forever changing it. And we don't know for sure, but probably it was universal, but by accident. Babbage certainly, as far as I can tell, did not understand the idea of universality. Ada Lovelace looks as if she did have an intuitive understanding that these things might do more than just manipulate numbers, but she didn't hit it head on, so I don't think it gets the prize, not on its own anyway. This is the second of our candidates. We're now into the Second World War. This was built by Konrad Zuse in Berlin. It's not very well known in this country, the Z3, but deserves to be better known. In my opinion, it is also universal by accident. In other words, it was thought of as a programmable calculator, not as a computer. It was not mechanical, it was electromechanical. It was made out of relays. My wife always says that I built my first computer out of relays. She's not correct. So that's the Z3. Then we get to the Colossus, which was built by Tommy Flowers at the Dollis Hill Research Station and then delivered to Bletchley Park in order to crack the Lorentz cipher, which was the successor to the Enigma cipher, and the good work done on Enigma would have been lost if they hadn't managed to crack the Lorentz cipher. So this is just as important. And this is made out of valves. And Tommy Flowers knew a secret that nobody else knew, including the Americans at the time, which is that valves, although normally unreliable, can be made reliable with a little trick. And the little trick is, don't turn them off. Leave the power on all the time. So that was the Colossus. Now, history doesn't show very much about whether Turing was heavily involved in this or not. But for my money, Turing's fingerprints are all over it. In fact, on the right there, you can see some paper tape. You don't really think this machine would have had paper tape if it wasn't for Turing? No, surely. Was it universal? Yes, it was, although Tommy Flowers is very modest about it when he writes about it. But nevertheless, I think it was. We've shown how to reprogram it. It did have to be taken apart and put back together, which took about 3 days. I reckon that this wasn't entirely by accident, because although it was built to solve one particular problem, the Lorentz cipher, they were afraid that other ciphers would come along. They had no idea what they would be like, and they wanted to be able to adapt this machine to crack any further ciphers that came along. So that's why I think it has a lot of elements of universality in it, by design. Some people claim that it wasn't universal when all the other four were. That is clear and utter bias, based on the fact that the Colossus was secret for so long and people don't want to rewrite history. It's clear to me that the Colossus deserves exactly the same dubious borderline status as the other machines on the list. So I'm not trying to claim too much. This is the American equivalent, the ENIAC. So it was also designed primarily to solve one problem, which was calculating the trajectories of missiles. But it was also designed to be general purpose reprogrammed to do something else, except they took 3 weeks to program theirs. But in many ways, it's an equivalent. I love the sign on this exhibit, by the way. It says, the world's first electronic, large-scale, general-purpose, digital computer. Didn't they realize that every time you add an adjective, you make it less impressive? After all, the first human being is an important concept. But the first Bristolian, red-headed, computer-loving, tea-hating human being, that's me. So there's the ENIAC. And then after the war, when everybody had had time to breathe a bit and get a team together, the Manchester Baby was built. Very tiny, just a demonstrator, but effectively the same as today's computers. It had a total of 128 bytes of memory. It had a total of 7 instructions, one of which was stop. And it ran at 1,000 instructions per second, which actually isn't bad. So back to the list. I am the judge. My decision is final. I am going to award the prize for programmability to the analytical engine, for practicality to the Z3. Electronic, the first one is Colossus. General purpose, I'm going to give that to ENIAC. And finally, I'm going to give the stored program prize to Baby. So today, we think of a computer in practical terms as a stored program, general purpose, electronic, practical, programmable machine. Okay. Where is the first computer in all this? In my opinion, it's an amalgam of these and therefore a joint effort between Germany, the UK, and the USA, which sounds fair to me. Okay, time for a 5-second breather. By the way, this is one of my favorite images. It's obviously rather derivative, so is it art? I will leave that question for you. So I want to change tack now that you know all about computer science, well, the first 2 or 3 steps, and I want to introduce you to one of my lecturers when I was a student, John Conway. You can probably see the beard all around, and you can imagine the sandals that he wore all the time. You'll have to take my word for the charisma, and his initials are JC. It's no wonder that he was a bit of an idol of ours at the time. He used to froth with ideas, and we said you could get a PhD from him by picking up the odd comments that he threw away in the common room and taking them back to him a day or two later when he'd forgotten. He's a mathematician, retired now, but he made one foray into computer science, which he's famous for, which he hates because he thinks that his mathematical successes have been overshadowed, but I can't help it because I'm a computer scientist. So we're going to talk about something you might have heard of, which is the game of life. This is another thing where there are thousands of websites where you can find out about it, but none of them tell you what the significance is. Isn't that dreadful? So I'm going to sort of mythically reproduce John Conway's thinking. So it goes something like this. In order to investigate the general property of life, what we'd like are lots of examples. And there's a problem because we've only got one. We've just got the one universe to look at. So why don't we create a new universe? So we've got two universes to look at. Surely we'll learn more from doing that. So let's create a new universe. What are we going to make it out of? Well, let's make it out of space, time, and matter. Why? Because actually we're not very creative beings and we can't think of anything better. But we'll leave out complicated stuff like energy, right? And we'll try and make it so simple that we can investigate, explore this universe in a computer. So we'll make space simple by making it two-dimensional. We will chop it up into squares. And we will make time quantized, so it goes through ticks, 0, 1, 2, 3, with 0 being the Big Bang. And we'll have to have a little think about matter, because one of the things we want to investigate is evolution. And one of the things we know about evolution is it takes an awfully long time. So we're going to cheat a bit and make matter work like biological cells instead of like atoms or subatomic particles or something. So when I used to talk about this thing a few years ago to students, I used to say at this point, did you know that I am actually a colony? I'm a collection of cells, essentially identical, who have decided to cooperate with each other. And that's me. And by the way, so are you. So cells are very important in our view of life. So that's kind of what we're trying to model. But we want to keep things pretty simple, so our laws of physics are going to be simple, and here they are. If an empty square has exactly three neighboring cells, then you'll get a new cell, but otherwise it'll stay empty. And if you've got a square with a cell in it, and there are exactly two or three neighbors, it'll survive and otherwise it'll die off. And these numbers, the twos and the threes, those are the fundamental constants of this universe, and they are chosen to make this universe interesting. So tiny little bit of maths for those who like it. You can work out, if you know what the population density is at one particular time, you can work out what it is on average at the next tick. P dashed equals something to do with P. And the 56 and those funny big numbers in there are the ways of choosing two or three neighbors. And you can plot a graph for these particular numbers that we've chosen, and the blue line is it, and where the blue line goes below the red one, you've got reducing population, and where it goes above, you've got increasing population, and the fact that the blue line goes back and forth across the red line suggests that this universe is an interesting one. And if you work out what the stable densities are, there are two of them. There's zero, which suggests there might be lots of empty space to play in. And there's another one around 0.37 or something, which is a decent kind of density for organisms to float about in this empty space. So that's good news. It's only rough, rule of thumb, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if Conway hadn't gone through that, probably just in his head, to come up with the right rules, the right fundamental constants for his universe. What else does a universe need? It needs initial conditions. And Conway has been very generous. He's basically thinking of an infinite random initial condition for the universe, and that means if you set out 100 by 100 square with your choice of cells in it, it'll be in there somewhere, so you can have a patch of his universe all to yourself. Isn't that good? So you set up the initial conditions, You press the play button and time starts and you watch. Not much of a game, you might say, but Conway calls this a zero-player game. All you do is watch. So here is what I believe was the first life configuration which was explored on a computer. And there are lots of apocryphal stories about how this came out, and I won't say them because I don't know how true they are. But we're going to watch what happens, and there's a kind of frothing that goes on, a kind of random building up of cells, and that's quite typical for random starting positions. And I've stopped time here. I've pressed the pause button on this universe because on the left, have I got a marker? Yeah, here, this upside-down L thing is a little organism, the first interesting organism which has crawled out of the primordial slime and is just about to head off to the northeast. So if I start it up again, you can watch it going off to the northeast. There it goes. And after a little while, I'm going to press the pause button again, and you might have noticed, if you've got sharp eyes, that another one has appeared here, rotated a bit, going off to the southeast. And it carries on like that. And these little things that waddle about are called gliders, for historical reasons, and they are everywhere in the Conway universe. They just pop up all the time. So it's not surprising that we've seen a couple already. Now, after a bit of watching, so there are various groups of people who get involved in this, and I like to give them names, and the group I'm looking at now are the biologists. They go out looking for things. So they start with random collections of cells, and they watch and see if anything happens. They spot something interesting. Here's something interesting that the biologist spotted. I'm going to call it a frog. Think of it as pointing to the right with powerful legs at the back. And I'm going to start it going, and it does this. So after a short while, it has gone into a different phase of its life cycles. It looks even more like a frog now, but it's left behind an embarrassing bit of waste. If I keep it going a little bit longer, you can see it has returned to its original phase of its life cycle, but pointing in the opposite direction. So you might think that it hops backwards and forwards indefinitely, but unfortunately it doesn't, because it's about to... Oh, excuse me. Short pause required. You might think it hops back and forward, but it in fact doesn't, because it's about to bump into its own waste and disappear in a huge explosion. So that's a rather unfortunate organism, which wasn't terribly successful in evolutionary terms. Now, we could wait for evolution to fix up the problems to give us a more decent frog, but at this point... that's going to take too long, so we leave the biologists out of it and we bring in a new set of people, and these are the genetic engineers. Now, the genetic engineers work hard at trying to find ways of improving the organisms that are already around. So if we look at what they produced this. So this is the improvement to the organism with a block at each end to bounce off. And when we start it up, we find that what the block does is to eat up the mess that got left behind so that the frog can hop backwards and forwards. This is called a shuttle. I didn't make up the names, but you can see what it does. Now, some more progress was required, but in order to make more progress, we had to get a third group of people in. And this group of people are the particle physicists. Now, the way particle physicists work is they smash stuff together to see what happens. And what they came up with was this. So you've got two frogs trundling backwards and forwards. They're in different phases of their life cycle. and there is a block at each end that they're bouncing off, but they're also bouncing off each other, which is what the particle physicists discovered. And when they do, something interesting happens, like so. A glider appears, and another one, and another one. And this is irritatingly called a glider gun. I can think of some lot better names for it, but there we go. So I need to compress history a bit and tell you what happened next. So what was discovered after this was that you could send off fleets of gliders into empty space, and along with the gliders you could send a countdown timer, and when the timer went off, it would stop the gliders, turn them to point in a different direction, place them in exactly the right positions, and then get them ready to do something at the other end of their travels. And to show you an example of that, press the right button, there it is. This is my favorite. So imagine that you've sent off some gliders and eight of them have been positioned accurately like this, so they're just about to bump into each other. And when these eight gliders bump into each other, guess what happens? Well, no, I'll show you. They build a glider gun. That is quite remarkable, isn't it? So I can't keep showing you these things forever. Please go off onto the web and find one of those 1,000 odd websites. But what I can tell you is that the significance of all this is that after some study, we've discovered that organisms in this alternative universe can evolve, grow, move, reproduce by making copies of themselves somewhere else, like I showed you. Communicate by sending streams of gliders to each other, and think. Oh, what? Think? Well, obviously we don't know exactly what thinking is, but we know one thing about it. It includes computation. So the only thing that we can test in this universe, that we know how to test, is whether or not organisms can evolve which are capable of doing arbitrary computation in their brains. And the answer is yes. So as far as we are able to test, intelligent life could evolve in this universe. In fact, there's a story of one computer scientist who studied this stuff who said that he felt pangs of guilt when he stopped the program because there were these organisms that he wasn't allowing to reach their potential. Maybe when you create a new universe, you've got some responsibility towards it. And Conway's universe has some really, really interesting parallels and contrasts with our own. So, for example, you can't reconstruct the past. You don't know exactly what happened. You can guess. You can't look forward to see what is going to happen in the future other than by waiting for it to come along. If you could, you could solve the halting problem. And so on. So, really interesting environment to look at, and totally deterministic, of course. All right, so there are a few little questions that I think arise from this for me. One is, there's this idea of fine-tuning for our universe, that it had to be exactly right in order for us to exist. Well, of course it did. But what this suggests is maybe you take another universe a bit further away with some different laws of physics and fine-tune that, and you probably find another universe which is just as interesting with intelligent life in it. Maybe any sufficiently complex environment will produce life. That's an interesting thought. And it adds, I think, a tiny little bit of evidence to the idea that maybe we're not alone in the universe. Current thinking is there are aliens out there, intelligent aliens, but we will never meet them, which is rather sad because we will never know the answer to the question, but still. I think there's an interesting question which is left, which is, why is our universe an interesting one and not a dull one? If you look at possible alternatives that Conway might have chosen, they're all dull. This is almost the only one that has any interest in it. So why is the universe interesting? I'm not trying to answer it, I'm just asking a question. Good. That's the end of part two. And now the final part is, what sort of questions are being asked these days that are relevant to what we've been talking about? So one, of course, is computer intelligence. A difficult topic, but nevertheless. I expect you all know about Deep Blue that won at chess a while ago, and I think everybody knows that it cheated. It used brute force, it wasn't intelligent. To me, that's quite interesting because there were some people that came a little bit after Turing who said, when a computer can play chess, I will know it's intelligent. And Turing had already said at the beginning of the subject, before there were any computers, that won't be good enough, which is quite amusing. So that doesn't tell us very much. But then earlier this year, the computer called AlphaGo won at the Go game, which is sort of equivalent difficult game to chess, some people say. I'm not an expert. That, I think, is a little bit more significant because it wasn't programmed to play Go well. It learnt to play Go well. Ironically, it uses a technique called deep learning, which is rather funny because human beings use shallow learning, or you could call it broad learning. So in computing, we can't go broad, so we have to go deep. I don't know if that has any significance because I'm not an expert, but I think it's quite funny. Anyway, so there's something going on. That's really all you can say from this. Computers are getting more intelligent in some sense. I know the intelligence is isolated in a single program and it's not self-aware and all that sort of stuff, but nevertheless, something is going on. Do we in computer science have an idea about whether computers ever will be properly intelligent or not? I would suggest that there's a consensus, but not a very strong one, that the answer is yes, probably based on the fact that most computer scientists that I know are extreme optimists. But the question arises, why aren't they intelligent right now? After we've been developing them for ages, they've been growing at an enormous rate in power. Why aren't they intelligent now? And I think there are two reasons. The first is, if you do a calculation on the back of an envelope, which is all you can do because you're comparing chalk with cheese, you discover that a computer, as we stand now, is less powerful than the human brain by a factor of, don't know what, a couple of orders of magnitude, I reckon. So if you look at your computer and say, stupid computer, yes, but it's only got a hundredth of your power of your brain. Maybe you should be a bit nicer to it. And the other thing is, of course, that we don't really know what intelligence is or how to program it yet. We're still working on it. So there are those two problems. Incidentally, I hope that you will... I mentioned the Turing test earlier on without telling you what its name was. Turing's test for whether a computer is intelligent or not is to talk to it across a huge range of subjects. And if it holds up under that, then maybe it's intelligent. If you can't tell the difference, what is the difference? So I hope you'll excuse me for quoting from Star Trek, but this is my favorite little bit. I'm not a fanatic, just a fan. A human is talking to a computer, an android, and the human says, you're just a machine. You can't write a symphony or paint a masterpiece, can you? And the computer says, no, can you? And I'm trying to get at the point that I think that genius level intelligence is not what we're after. It's a distraction. Same with creativity and emotions and robot bodies and all that sort of thing. They're distractions for me. Just to get a computer to show ordinary, everyday, human-style intelligence, like recognizing faces, understand what you're talking about, knowing what you meant and not what you actually said, things like that. That's all we would like, so that we can communicate more easily with the beasts. Incidentally, science fiction tends to show computers and androids and so on as emotionless in the future. I don't get that, because emotions are infinitely easier than intelligence. By the time we've made them intelligent, surely we can give them emotions. So there we go. So here's my summary of the situation. I think there are three possible things that could happen in the future, assuming the human race doesn't obliterate itself. One is that we might find there's a limit on how intelligent computers can get. There's no sign of it at the moment, which I think is the reason for the optimism. computers are just creeping upwards in intelligence. When you discover that your computer is more intelligent than your dog, you might start thinking a bit harder about what's going on, mightn't you? Another thing that might happen is that we find out how to mimic human intelligence, maybe by getting a computer to interact with its environment for 18 years before it develops an adult level of intelligence. I don't know. I don't think so. I think that's unlikely. I think the story might be rather like the story of flight. We still don't know, really, how to mimic birds in flight. But we fly, we just use fixed wings. And I think we might get the same thing. Intelligence will evolve in computers, but it'll be a different kind of intelligence. And probably, because our subject is driven by economics, unfortunately, it's the aspects of computer intelligence that complement our skills, which are the ones which will be developed. Good. And I've got one more tiny little thing to talk about. I know I'm talking for too long, but never mind. What's missing? So is there something in the human brain that goes beyond what a computer can do and that a computer will never have, right? You might call it a soul, but let's sort of set our sights a little lower and ask about self-awareness, and then let's set our sights a little lower and talk about free will. Free will is a very hot topic of conversation at the moment because, well, for all sorts of reasons, and it's a debate that's to do with whether humans have free will, let alone computers. And clearly, computer science does have something to say about this, I think. And I've picked free will because it's the thing which sort of people come up against and say, yes, but computers are deterministic, they're never going to have some sort of free will like what we've got. So what is the computer science answer to the question of free will? Well, of course, it's not just computer scientists, it's everybody getting involved. And I think if you want to find out what is thought about these subjects, you should follow one of the two tribes, or possibly both. So there's a yes tribe, and to find out what they say, go and look up Roger Penrose and his followers and see what they have to say about it. And there's a no tribe, and if you want to find out what they say, start with Daniel Dennett, probably. Okay, so I'm going to quickly show you what I think about the arguments on both sides. So one idea on the yes side is that maybe randomness is the key. There's something in the human brain that generates randomness or finds randomness from somewhere, and that randomness enables you to do things which are not deterministic. But I don't like this idea because, for a start, it's insulting. You know, when somebody says to you, you're just a machine, that's insulting. If they say you're just a random machine, that's even more insulting. That phrase, you're just a machine, or are you just a machine, I don't know whether it's wrong because actually we are better than machines, or whether it's wrong because the word just shouldn't be there and machines are being done down. Could be either, but I think it's wrong. But in any case, there's plenty of randomness available without having some magic way of producing it in the human brain. You can just suck in randomness from the environment, as we know in computers, because that's what computers do. Another thing that the ES tribe says is that there are some quantum effects maybe going on in the human brain, and we all know that quantum effects are seriously weird. I don't want to go into too much technical detail. And maybe that weirdness takes us beyond what an ordinary computer can do. And when I first read this, I thought it was a whole load of nonsense. And then I started discovering that there are some quite interesting things being done these days. The usual argument is that quantum effects are on a very small scale, and as soon as the scale gets bigger, you get this thing called decoherence, which means that the quantum effects kind of fizzle out. But there is some work being done in biology which suggests that biological mechanisms have found ways around this. One of the possibilities is photosynthesis, which might be a way of taking a quantum effect and kind of blowing it up so that it still has consequences at a bigger, on a bigger scale. It's still very early days, so I don't know where this is going, but there are interesting signs. So I no longer want to rule out, in my gut feeling, I no longer want to rule out the possibility of there being interesting quantum effects somewhere deep down in the brain. But I think I'm still on the side of saying this isn't a really good argument, because we in computing know that computers rely on quantum effects, and the first thing we do is wipe them out so that the slate is clean and we get ordinary deterministic computation. And I have a sneaking suspicion that biology, evolution, might have said the same thing, that these quantum effects in the brain are actually a bad thing, cover them up, next thing that happens, there's nothing left. So I don't know. I'm speculating like everybody else. But I can't help mentioning something called the free will theorem, which suggests that there may be some link, actually, between quantum effects and free will. The free will theorem is down to John Conway, the same one I talked about earlier. So this is his dabbling in physics. He teamed up with a proper quantum theorist to do this. And from a physics point of view, this is a really run-of-the-mill paper. But from our point of view, it has some of the right words in it and is quite suggestive. So the idea is that what is free will? Let's try and simplify it. Let's say that free will is whenever something happens that isn't deterministic, that isn't just a function of the previous history of the universe up to that point. And you know that with philosophers, there is always one thing that you can never eliminate, which is that nothing exists, right? I like to call it the null hypothesis. In this sort of situation, there's also something that you can never disprove, and that is that everything is deterministic, that every experiment you do, the outcome, the decisions that you made, the thoughts that you have, all entirely deterministic. But if you rule that out and allow that human beings can make choices, then particles also make choices. So the idea is you do an experiment, and part of the experiment is the experimenter making a choice as to what measurements to make. And if you allow that, then the particles will make a choice, which is not deterministic, about what result to show you. And there can't be any hidden variables, right? There's no way that there's something about a particle that we've not measured yet, we don't know how to detect it, which tells it what to do in these circumstances. That doesn't work. So, seriously weird, that's the summary. And I think this is a hint that there might be some sort of connection between quantum stuff and free will. But it's open to interpretation. Everything in the quantum world is difficult to interpret, so there are arguments about it all over the place. I just thought I'd mention it on the way past, partly to make Conway happy, because he doesn't like being mentioned only in the context of the game of life. Some people go further and say that the human brain might be like a quantum computer. Quantum computation is a subject which we've been working really hard on for quite a while now. Not me, I'm not an expert. But my summary, which could be wrong as a non-expert from the outside, but my summary of the things that we've discovered over the last few decades is this. Quantum computation is a bit weird because only certain operations are allowed, so there was some discussion at the beginning as to whether you could do full computation at all with quantum effects. After a while, it was determined that yes, you can, and then the discussion turned to, well, could you perhaps go beyond ordinary computation with quantum effects? And the answer seems to be no. And I think that breaks this argument for the yes tribe, that you can't go beyond ordinary deterministic computation. All you can do is do things faster. Because although the operations are restricted, you can kind of do as many of them at the same time as you like, which is where the speed comes from. Incidentally, you might have heard other conjectures about what quantum computation can do. I believe the consensus now is They can't break the hard problems. Hard problems, that's a technical term meaning a problem which is solvable in principle, but not in practice, because it'll take longer than the age of the universe. So it seems that quantum computation can't break that barrier and solve these hard problems, but it does seem to be solving some intermediate problems. Those are problems that I think of as impractical by accident. In other words, we can't sort of put them in the hard category. We can show that they're impractical. They just happen to be impractical, and we don't really know why. Factorization goes in that category. Some of you may know that means that if and when quantum computation becomes really practical, it will change the face of cryptography rather severely. It won't disappear. It'll have to change a lot, though. Good. Okay, so that's my summary of quantum computation. We're nearly there. So let's have a quick look at the No tribe. So what the No tribe says is free will actually isn't all that special. It's based on just ideas of determinism. If there are quantum effects, they don't affect the argument. And that free will is a kind of an emergent property. And the way it's emergent is really to do with the environment. So if you take an organism in the game of life and you sit it in blank space, it looks totally deterministic. You know exactly what it's going to do. It's going to do the same as last time. But if you put it in a complex environment where there are things firing gliders at it from the outside, suddenly you've got a chaotic environment, a random-looking environment, and everything changes. You can no longer sort of kind of predict what's going to happen. And their idea is that our environment is hugely, hugely, hugely important to us. That if we were in sensory deprivation from birth, we would be vegetables. That we are who we are because of our interactions with the environment. And it also tests us after it's taught us by saying, here's some new challenges that you've got to overcome. Quite an interesting point of view, I think. So there are one or two other arguments on the no side. One is that you don't need any magic. The yes tribe seem to be trying to explain something we don't understand, free will, using something else we don't understand, quantum theory. I guess we here believe that God works through science, not magic, so that's a slight argument in the favor of no. And also, it's really easy to give free will to computers. You may know that Google is experimenting with self-drive cars, and the accident rate is way down. The reason that we don't usually give free will to computers is because they're not intelligent enough to know what to do with it. But as they become more intelligent, we will be able to give them more headroom, more free will. So I think... here's my summary of the situation. The arguments of the yes tribe are almost impossible to believe. The arguments of the no tribe are almost impossible to believe. But presumably one of them is almost right, or more or less right. So how do you decide? Well, I've come to a decision for myself, which is that I'm in the no tribe, and that's really because, to me, both Christianity and science have something in common that they teach us, and that's humility. And that the answer with more humility is often the right one we've seen through history. So that's my solution to the question, but you're entitled to make your own decision. I'll just leave you with a picture of free will and see if there are any difficult questions. Thank you.
Right, I've got a roving mic here. Does anyone feel like being a runner? Paul, do you want to do that? I'll just start off with a question, actually. What's really curious about this is that it's come full circle, because one of the first talks we did, Christians and Science, back in 2008, was about free will. So it's rather nice it's come back to that. And I think to get the insights of computer science is actually giving a lot more substance, just material to work with, when you talk about free will, because it, you know, it's just informing you, isn't it? I think, and what's really nice is it's kind of kicking off our science informing faith series by giving. Because I think sometimes, you know, being Christians is you know, and you have faith and everything, but to have actual knowledge and, you know, things to actually build arguments with is just a really, really impressive bit, I think. So just a sort of pre-thank you for that. I mean, personally, I'm kind of in the no free will camp simply because we're creatures. I don't know. I just, and as you say, this sort of humility is just to say, well, you know, if I was in a different country or a different culture, in a different economic state, you're very different, and we can predict what our husbands and sons are about to do in the first next five seconds. So I tend to go into that camp, and I don't have a problem with it. I really don't. I think it's marvellous to be alive. I think it's great to be able to express your ideas and interact with people. So I don't feel threatened by that. Do we want to talk about free will right now, or are there questions about the technicalities of some of the ideas?
One thing I forgot to say, I'm sorry, you are still responsible for your actions.
But that's about consequence, isn't
yes.
it? It's more about saying your actions have consequences, you need to realise those consequences and change what you do next time. Is that what you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, anyone else with some comments about free will or...
I was afraid of this. My expert colleagues.
It's already your colleagues.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm one of Ian's colleagues. So there's this really interesting interplay in quantum about so there's this law called Bell's inequality, and Bell's inequality is really interesting because it says that either we have locality, that is to say, the effects that we see in a system are completely determined by what's in that system, but we must therefore have non-determinism, that is to say, we have what you would call free will. Or we have non-locality, which is to say that you can't analyze a system in its own context, that there may be some external force that operates on things, but in that case we have determinism, i.e. no free will. So do we think that there's an external force that can operate on our universe, therefore there is no non-determinism, and that is no free will? Or do we think that there is no external force that can play with the universe, in which case there is free will?
I'm going to take that as a comment rather than a question, I think.
I think I
can say it better than you.
But I think the challenge from the floor, if you like, is that having a God compounds the problem of free will. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if there's a God and he has an idea, in fact, and the Bible is full of these sorts of problems, I don't know if you're, are you Christian yourself? Yeah, so how do you deal with that? A bit like that, Ian. That's great. Any other questions? Oh, go on, Chris.
I'm not a scientist, I have no expertise in computers whatsoever. I'm the worst example you could get of all that. Anyway, but on the free will determinism debate, if we're determined, we might be determined to have free will. And if we have free will, it might be that we have free will to be determined. So it seems to me that almost this is a false dichotomy that's been, if you like, created by philosophers or whoever else. And that maybe it's diverting us from deeper understandings at other levels about this area. In other words, we, in a sense, it ends up where you were. I realise you were putting it in simple terms, but it's polarising the debate. You're either this tribe or you're that tribe.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's a very difficult subject to think about, and I actually took out of the talk, because it was getting a bit long, a few slides with a kind of philosophical thought experiments of my own, which I'm pretty sure I stole from Daniel Dennett in looking back at it, but you know, I sort of read what he said and tried to condense it down. And I think one of the confusions is that if you know what someone is going to do, then you tend to think they don't have free will. And I don't think that's right. So that I set up this series of thought experiments, as I say, not original, but thought experiment one was, today I'm looking back and remembering a decision I made yesterday. Does the fact that I remember my decision mean that I didn't have free will at the time? Of course not, right? But then, if you gradually turn it around and imagine God outside of time, knowing what you're going to do, does that mean you don't have free will? No, because it's essentially the same situation. It's like God remembering the decision that you're about to make, if you know what I mean. So then you imagine God at the end of time, and it's the same story. And so even in quite severe-looking circumstances where you think that's got to be totally deterministic, there can't be any free will, you need to hedge your bets. Maybe there is some left there somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a really, really difficult thing to think about, and I haven't stopped thinking about it. I'm, still reading all the things. So it's really difficult.
I think one thing that strikes me about when we are making decisions is that are we doing something that computers can't do, and that we're comparing pears and bananas, and we're weighing one sort of reason against another. So there might be an economic reason for something, there might be an emotional, might be an ethical, and then you sort of juggle them together in your head, and then according to your character, which someone else might be able to predict, they know that you're the sort of person who'd go for the emotional reason. So my mum functions emotionally, and we're very good at predicting what she's about to say or do. But can computers do that? Can they compare different types of reasonings, different types of data, different...
Well, I think we're moving into that situation. So up until now, all the intelligence that computers have displayed has been sort of inside one tiny little problem or one tiny little program. And it's starting to escape. We're starting to see computers looking at a wide variety of things and making decisions. So, one subject that we do in our department, for example, is data mining. What you do is you take a huge amount of data, you give it to the program, and you say, please find me something interesting in here. Right? So you aren't putting very many constraints on what it can do. And some interesting discoveries have been made that way. And also by giving the data to schools and all sorts of other techniques.
And
if you think about the way the Google Drive self-drive cars work, they have to make a very wide range of judgments in order to do what they do. Mm-hmm. So, I think we are seeing the kind of intelligence that computers show gradually expand out from these tiny little.
Isn't there a sense of sort of weighting factors? So if you think
about... I said free will is easy to give computers. All you do is you give it a way of working out what its options are and a way of judging how good each one is, and then it picks the best. Not difficult.
So then you've given it the weighting factors.
I know, yeah. You've told it what to do. Yes.
Are there any consequences of that?
Well, it's a common theme of science fiction that suddenly the computers on the internet joined up together will become intelligent. I don't see that, because the way the computers on the internet talk to each other is a big mess. It needs to be organized to become intelligent, and that's either by us working out what should happen or by a very, very, very long process of evolution, which we haven't even started yet, tens of thousands of years.
Do you believe that, because it seems to me that intelligence... it seems to me, obviously, the definition of intelligence is important here, but I guess one of the difficult problems is the experience of consciousness, of internal states.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we feel it's so abhorrent when someone refutes that we have free will is our intuitive experience every day of exercising it. And I guess when we think about computers, my question is, Can you imagine them developing the kind of conscious experience that we have? And what would that look like? Is that a function of complexity? What would that, how would that happen?
I think the main thing is that we don't know. So does your dog have self-awareness? How would you tell anyway? Does it have a little bit of self-awareness maybe? You know, is recognizing yourself in a mirror, does that count as self-awareness? So I think that the only answer I can give is the one Turing gave at the beginning of our subject. The only way to know whether a computer is self-aware is talk to it for a long time, build up a relationship with it, and decide the way you decide with other people.
That problem exists with your spouse as well.
Yeah. Yes. 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 Yes.
And so it's true that we've never known as a computer would have had developed consciousness.
Yeah.
But the theoretical problem as to whether it could is a problem at all. Anyone else? I think it would be worth it.
I hope you'll forgive the simplicity of this question. Whether the answer is another question. Could a computer ever conceivably replace a jury? Now, let's assume that somebody is accused of shoplifting. A fellow shopper thinks that the person helped themselves and is almost sure, but isn't quite. The store detective is sure that the person took it. But there's something a bit worrying about the store detective, and we're not quite sure of his personality, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
Is it ever conceivable that a computer might be able to make those kind of evaluative choices, decisions?
I think that question is already arising with the self-drive cars. If there's an accident, who do you put in jail? Right? You know, what happens if you blame the car? All you can say about the cars is that the overall average accident rate is down. You can't actually stop accidents happening. And then who do you blame? It's not easy, is it? Computers are increasingly making judgments. My favorite example recently was a program which was developed to take old-fashioned IQ tests. That means it needs to understand the words and the sentences and come up with the right answer, and it's got an IQ of about 200. Now, that's all it can do. I know it's, you know, it's narrow and it's not all that impressive, but nevertheless, it can do old-fashioned IQ tests quite a bit better than I can. That's annoying. So we are seeing the beginnings of judgment calls. Now, juries, since you brought them up, don't have a very good track record of getting things right because you can't easily tell what actually happened. And it seems to me that the same sort of situation would arise. If you had a computer acting as a jury, it would make mistakes probably less often, but the sort of mistakes would be very different. And you have to judge whether the reduced mistake rate is acceptable in your moral sphere or not. I don't know what I would think.
Did you want to come back on that? Okay. There's a question over here. Gentleman in the red tie.
I'm an empty nester. In other words, I was a parent and now the kids have left home and they make their own mistakes. But a computer still remains dependent. If a computer-controlled car crashes, the programmer goes to jail. They have to be held responsible.
Yep.
It seems to me that whilst my children had a measure of intelligence and they were at home, they were dependent upon me. There came a difficult period where I had to work out, you know, how much freedom they had, an adolescent period. period, shall we say, before they could go on and take responsibility for their own decisions. Mm. At what point do we hold computers responsible for the decisions they make? That's what's partly underlying the jury question, yeah. I think, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And who decides?
Well,
are we at the stage where my computer, which I sometimes abuse, would ask me if it could have a better owner? Are we at the stage where a computer says, I can't cope with Windows 10, I'd like to commit suicide?
I like this question. I think the answer is that we have to do it as a community, and I think all of us, me included, would say at the moment we're far, far too nervous to make computers responsible for too much. But if and when, as a community, we feel we are able to give computers more responsibility, we will probably also have to give them more rights. So I think we've got a tough time coming if it comes to that. Quite a tough time. I think there has to be a sea change, that computers have to be seen to be generally, in almost all circumstances, reliable and sensible. And they're definitely not at the moment. But when they are, our attitudes to them might change.
Peter Bruce, are we running away with ourselves in trying to answer these very universal problems of free will and everything else when our understanding is really very, still very limited in the 3D, when we know from most science that it's sort of probably 9D or 11D or whatever, so our system that we're drawing the box around is a very limited brain, a 3D one, whereas if the mind is actually working in 9D consciousness and everything else, that the external force can be lots of things of free will before you even come to God, been including in.
Yeah, I don't quite know what to say to that.
Can you try to simplify the question, perhaps?
So if you took the mind as 3D only and you're analysing it in that sense of free will, but actually the external force, as your colleague was saying, is in the seventh dimension or eighth dimension and is affecting our mind, and therefore the workings of the 3D brain through that, then free will can exist well outside our understanding of the 3D brain. Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is we don't know enough yet.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. Computer scientists do not have a terribly good reputation, any better than anybody else, for foreseeing the future, where things might go or how our understanding might evolve. So everything I've been saying is huge guesswork based on rather simple linear extrapolation. So who knows? One of the things, I think I mentioned it earlier, that irritates me is that the development of computer science is partly driven by money, and there are quite a lot of really fascinating inventions sitting on shelves that happen not to have become commercial, which I would like to see because I've tried them and I love them, and I'd like to be able to afford one instead of having to borrow some research equipment from somebody. So at some stage I'll tell you some of them. Yeah.
I think your question, so what's your name, by the way? Peter Bruce. I think what Peter was trying to bring in again was the idea of God and perhaps a non-deterministic interaction of God with minds such as ours. And you're suggesting perhaps that that's where we find the free will. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That so maybe God's Holy Spirit gives us... That's right. So just as you get non-deterministic sort of strange effects with complex systems, like waves or, you know, cyclones and weather patterns and everything, that because, and so I mean, think what you were saying originally, wasn't it, that you felt having an external force was taking the free will away, you're coming in and saying, well, maybe if it's a non-deterministic interaction with a multidimensional thing, maybe that is rescuing us and giving us free will. Does anyone want to comment on that? And how, our experience as Christians of God and his guidance, does that feel to us like something that's enabling us to make good choices? And I think non-Christians might feel that are we robots and God's telling us to do something we've got to do? How does it feel to us? Is it better free will when we are Christians and following God's guidance, or is it, you know, any stories on that? Has anyone felt guided by God about a particular anecdote? Anyone? No? I can give you one. So, go on, yes. Patrick, can we just get on to afterwards, because I've just raised a question. I quite like people to respond. So I think we're still talking about free will, and we'll get on to death maybe later. Yeah. But right now, I'm just quite interested to hear from people what their experience of choices are, because that's a big thing about free will, is the choices. And does having God in the equation help the experience of freedom of choice, or does it feel like you have to do this and that's taking away your free will? Anyone? Go on.
I think it goes back to the sort of, I come from a sort of Marxist tradition way back, and there's a phrase that he used which may or may not be helpful, which is, man makes his history and circumstances not of his own choosing. And I think that can be applied in a way to what you're saying. So we are presented with a set of possibilities, and as individuals, some of those we can look back, as you pointed out, historically, we've got come to a certain stage in our lives. But I think what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that we do have choice. I think that goes with a sort of Christian understanding, as far as I'm concerned, the sort of Protestant tradition, if you like, to some extent. And that really is our responsibility. The wider society and all our influences help us shape those decisions.
I think I put the yes tribe and the no tribe in rather stark contrast. I don't think it's really about does free will exist or doesn't it. I think it's more about free will definitely exists, but what is it? So I am planning to act as if I have free will for the rest of my life, and I'm planning to be responsible for my consequences of my actions, and I hope you are. So it's not what is, it's not do we have free will, we've definitely got something. It's how do you explain it, or what is it, or where does it come from, or those are the questions we really don't know the answer to. But I like the yes-no debate, because being a computer scientist, I like questions with yes and no answers.
So you got a question there?
My question is not about free will, I'm sorry, but my first question is that people now are talking about deep learning and or anything about artificial intelligence, but I remember artificial intelligence was also popular in 1960s. People were very optimistic about it and said let the computer compose a song very soon, and finally they just get very deep depression, found it is very hard, and even with the technique in those times they cannot do that. So do you think the history will be repeat again, because we have so many achievements, AlphaGo, Google Drive, anything like that, but do you think history will repeat again, finally find that the learning technique we have nowadays is not so powerful as we think or as we expect? And my second question is that, two questions. My second question is that, do you think to build a human-like, self-conscious artificial intelligence is an engineering problem, or there is a theoretical gap between human mind and our computer techniques? Because we have well-developed learning theories, statistics learning, so many theories, but do you think these theories can enable us to have techniques to build a human-like artificial intelligence self-awareness?
I think you've got two really good questions. So, first question first, are we too optimistic in thinking about artificial intelligence? Well, the first person I know who made lots of comments about artificial intelligence was Alan Turing just after the war. So, computer scientists have a history of saying that artificial intelligence is just around the corner. We've always been doing it. So you have a really good point. It isn't coming tomorrow. We are looking quite a way ahead. With my back of the envelope calculation, I reckoned that we need two or three more decades before computers are powerful enough to start doing the kind of experiments that would help us try to find out what intelligence is. All right, so I think we're a good way away. And then your second question was, would we ever have a computer that that has a human-like intelligence that appears to be self... We can't say is self-aware. We can only say appears to be self-aware when we chat with it. I really, really don't know. That's the honest answer. I really, really don't know. Yeah. Nick, again. I did not plant Nick and tell him to ask good questions.
No, he didn't plant me. So I really liked what you said about computers having responsibilities and therefore having rights. And it sort of makes me wonder when computers have rights and responsibilities and when they make mistakes, will they need forgiveness? And will there be a saviour?
Yes. I am not even going to try to answer that question. There is a limit to my speculation.
Sorry.
But it's obviously a question that might come up eventually.
I just say that the Faraday Institute has a project that is running on whether, as computers develop, they will get to the point where they will have a relationship with God and need forgiveness. And there's actually a whole project, because Christians are often behind the curve, and they want to be ahead of the curve on this one.
Yeah, thank you.
I think something really interesting here. So if you want to go off to the pub, and it steams just over there, it's Clifton End Station. So as you come out of here, the station, you go straight down, and it says Steam, and it's a new pub. I can sense this just rolling and rolling. Patrick, your question about death. Christians obviously believe one thing, atheists another. Ultimately, we're going to just have wait and see, that's my opinion, you know, and that we're going on the supposition there's something after death. Other people go on the supposition there's nothing. And maybe that's a question of choice, I don't know, of what strategy you're going to adopt. But maybe not quite the place to go into it right now. And I think it's yes, that's right. Yeah, it used to be called a rhubarb. That's right. So where you think the rhubarb would have been is where Steam now is. Do you recommend it, Patrick? Yeah, it's all right, is it? Yeah, okay. Oh, well. Well, let's try it out anyway. How about that? Give him a chance. See you later on. And obviously, please take lots of leaflets. I don't want to see any in there anymore. And please try and spread them around pubs and bars and cafes and your friends at work. And really good to give Keith Ward a really good reception in Bristol. And obviously, then that kind of kickstarts 2017. And just another thank you to Ian. I didn't know what to expect, actually. I asked Ian quite a while ago if he'd ever thought of doing a talk, and he came back to me about 6 months later saying he thought of a topic, and I didn't dare sort of, you know, inquire. And it's just been amazing. I just didn't know, you know, I just didn't know what... Because there's so much you can talk about with computers, isn't it? And I just felt what you've given us is such a nice historical, conceptual, you know, built Lego right from the word go, that you sort of feel you sort of understand it, and the principles, and you can actually see it growing up, and I think it gives maybe more sympathy of computing generally, and perhaps more excitement about what could happen, and maybe less sense of threat
I think so many Christians feel very threatened about the idea. But really, we should be quite excited about it and thinking, gosh, you know, we're creatures, these are new creatures, who knows what can happen? And let's not feel that they're going to take over the world, because we are their masters, I think, and we're setting the parameters. You know, we write the programs, and okay, maybe one day, but who knows? But thank you again, Ian. Let's give them a good...